Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting, broadcasting, broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world, to the world, to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Listening to Healing with Dr. Daniels, Blog Talk Radio, and this is Tuesday, December 31st, 2013. If murder were legal, would you do it? This is an important question, and an extension of this is it okay for the government to murder Americans? If so, then of course we've got no quarrel. But if not, if we say no, not at any time under any circumstances, then there would be a basis for objecting to the laws that permit and even obligate the FDA to engage in behavior that has been responsible for 107,000 deaths. That's if you take the number admitted to by the Journal of the American Medical Association, and as much as 861,000 deaths, if you use my calculations, in 2012. So, to be generous, if you exclude death due to doctors who deviated from the standard of care, approximately 92,000 deaths a year, that would be 871,000 deaths that could be attributed to the routine use of FDA-approved drugs and devices. This makes death from war seem, while regrettable, almost minuscule. Certainly, FDA-approved drugs appear to be a much greater threat even than terrorism. So what I'd like to do today is take a look at the employment implications of this killing machine. Then I'd like to look at the various FDA programs that make this possible and actually facilitate this. And then I'd like to take a look at the, or share with you, industry economic projections and analysis of FDA activities. And this, I think, is important because it will give you insight into the motivation of what's going on. And then, of course, finally, what each and every person can do to solve this. And, of course, writing your congressman or picketing is totally unnecessary. I don't encourage either one of those. In fact, even voting might be optional. Well, first, let's take a look at the employment implications. There are 244 million employed Americans. This is a tough number to get at, but the government would only confess to how many people were looking for work, which would be, and out of work, which would be 90 million, and that this represented quite a bit, actually 36% of the employable population. So if you take this and you multiply it or divide it up, you get to a number of 244 million Americans are employed. 17% of those are employed in healthcare, and that would give us a number of 41.4 million employed in healthcare, and engaged in the occupation of facilitating the murder of their fellow citizens. So let's take a look and see what's going on with the FDA. Well, first of all, I would like to suggest that while a person might object to the activities of the FDA, the activities are absolutely, totally, and perfectly legal. That's number one. Number two, I think that there are many laws that actually obligate the FDA to approve drugs that are more dangerous than maybe what has historically been approved. And it may be murder, but it's certainly legal. So here we go. Our first law to take a look at is the Orphan Products Grants Program. And this comes from the Orphan Products Drug Act. The Orphan Products Drug Act was created for ostensibly the compassionate reason that many drugs, this is in 1983, that many drugs were not being developed and were not being marketed because they serve such a small population, they would not be profitable. Hence, if we improve the profits of the drug companies for developing these drugs, then people who suffer from diseases that don't affect very many people would have drugs at their disposal, and as a result of having those drugs, they would then be healthier. And so what they call it is the humanitarian use or the orphan drug program, and it started in 1983. And there are many provisions of this program. Now, I want you to notice that how helping a small number of people has been translated into a mission to increase profits for the drug companies. This is very important. You know, over the years, well, as many of you know, I have an MBA from Warden in Healthcare Administration. And it's been shocking to me how every single healthcare problem can only be solved. It can only be solved by increasing the profits of drug companies or insurance companies or hospitals. And that's it. There is no other solution to improving the health of U.S. citizens except to increase the profits of one of these three special interest groups. No one's thought of increasing the profits or wealth of the U.S. citizens, but I don't know, I guess this is the way it works. So there's the Orphan Products Grants Program. This means our government, the federal government, is giving grants to drug companies that have orphan products. And these products can be drugs or biologicals or medical devices or medical foods. And there's a whole a slew of lists that are eligible. So what does this do? The government gives these grants to ensure that product development occurs in a timely manner and with a very modest investment. Well, not modest investment on whose part? The drug companies. Okay. So in general, this grant funding lasts for about 4 years. At any one time, there's about 85 ongoing funded projects, and a major portion of the funds is about $14 million. So a given year, about $14 million. And they go, a lot of it goes towards continued funding of prior approved grants. So a rapid increase in the cost of individual clinical trials in recent years has meant they couldn't increase the number of grants they give out. How sad. Now, usually they take about 15 new grants a year, so that's very interesting. In case you want to apply for one, you know what your chances are. Now, the feeling was that the FDA, having given these grants, would then be able to have site visits. And that would guarantee them that the FDA's exposure to risk violations and human subjects protection requirements would be minimized. Now, so these grant program provides incentives for sponsors to develop products for rare diseases. Now, there's also the Orphan Drug Designation Program. Now, this is one for you to listen to. This provides orphan status to drugs and biologics which are defined as those intended for the safe and effective treatment. Not those that are safe and effective, but those that are intended for the safe and effective treatment. Notice that wording. So it doesn't have to be safe. It doesn't have to be effective. It just has to be intended. And so also the diagnosis or prevention of rare diseases that affect fewer than 200,000 people in the United States, or more than 200,000 persons, but the drug company does not expect it would recover the cost of developing and marketing such a treatment. Okay. Now, they have a parallel program for devices and a parallel program for pediatric issues. Okay, so now we're going to grant to individuals, corporations, to develop drugs that they intend to be safe and that they intend to be effective, but they're not necessarily and don't have to be. Then once you get the orphan drug designation, then the FDA is authorized to give fast-track treatment. And this is a special process. This is a fast-track process. It's designed to facilitate the development and expedite, that means make faster, the review of drugs to treat serious conditions and fill an unmet medical need. Now, what is an unmet medical need? An unmet medical need, I'm telling you my definition of unmet medical need. This is an individual who is experiencing extreme distress and would gladly give their whole fortune if there were a drug available to help them. That's an unmet need. And the way you meet that need is by providing a drug that would indeed consume that person's total earthly possessions. So an unmet medical need is an individual who is suffering intensely and would pay a large amount of money, even so much as liquidating all their assets and possessions, to get what they perceive to be relief. And so meeting that need means giving them the opportunity to liquidate all their assets to pay for a particular drug or therapy. Okay, so Fast Track addresses a broad range of serious conditions. So what's serious? Well, the FDA has a little bit of honesty about this. So determining whether a condition is serious is a matter of judgment. Now, what does matter of judgment mean? Matter of judgment means that the individual making the decision can never in retrospect found to be wrong because there is no criteria that would indicate what serious is. So leaving serious undefined. So serious, you can replace the word serious with anything. So deciding whether a condition is serious or anything, a matter of judgment. So it's a blank check to whoever the reviewer happens to be. There is no criteria for serious. So you're saying generally is based on whether a drug will have an impact on such factors as survival or day-to-day function, or the likelihood that the condition, if left untreated, will progress from a less severe condition to a more serious one. Now, this is pretty outrageous. So if a person is 17 years old and they are allowed to continue their life, at 17, their health will be at whatever level it is, chances are if they are left alone and allowed to continue their life to the age of, say, 65 or 70, their health, and it has been left untreated, will become more serious. In other words, their health will have progressed from a less severe condition, which it was at age 17, to a more serious one, which it will certainly be at age 65, say. Does that mean that they should be taking a drug in between? Does that mean because the individual age 65 is no longer able to run sprints and jump hurdles that they should be on an orphan drug? I don't think so, but this is what the FDA's guidelines are. And so what they're saying is things like AIDS, which, again, you can go check one of my prior recordings about the AIDS situation. Alzheimer's, heart failure, and cancer are obvious examples of serious conditions. Now, without going too deep into it or much digression, AIDS, there's no evidence that having AIDS or being designated as AIDS or HIV positive has a life-shortening impact. Alzheimer's is a disease that did not exist 30 years ago. And so it's clear if you have a new disease hitting the horizon that's exploded to the point of Alzheimer's, where it's now responsible for 95,000 deaths a year, it would be good to look for an environmental cause for that one. And heart failure, if you listen to my recording on the heart disease hoax, is easily cured in 1 week or less by dietary changes. And cancer, we have, of course, the cancer scandal, where more than half of all diagnosed cancers would not result in a shortening of the person's life if the person did not receive therapy. So, given these emotionally charged health labels here, but on closer inspection, these examples are not necessarily ones that would progress from one condition to a far worse condition if left untreated. And two, certainly in the case of Alzheimer's, the intervention, if you want to call it that, would be to identify the environmental factor which has changed and to alter that, and that would basically prevent Alzheimer's. However, this is the criteria the FDA has, and they're saying diseases like epilepsy, depression, and diabetes are also considered serious conditions. Okay, so now what we're coming up with is just what I said before, that every disease fits the definition of serious. So filling an unmet need is defined as providing a therapy where none exists, as what I said before, the opportunity to spend your fortune or your whole net worth or take your whole family into debt where before you had no such opportunity. And providing a therapy which may be potentially better. Now, we have two qualifiers. One is maybe, and then the other one is potentially. So it's like maybe, maybe. So this is a double qualifier indicating the available therapy may actually be better than the orphan drug, that's really not a criteria. So the therapy is an opportunity for the individual to spend a lot of money, the sick individual, whereas before they could not spend as much money on treating their condition. And two, the therapy does not need to be any better than available therapy. Okay, so what they're saying then is any drug being developed to treat or prevent a condition for which no current therapy obviously is directed at an unmet need. So if there are available therapies, then a fast-track drug must show some advantage over available therapy. So if there is not an available therapy, then the fast-track drug does not need to show superiority or effectiveness in any way. So if there is another drug already out there, then the fast-track drug, or to get fast-track treatment, has to show either more effectiveness or improved effect on a serious outcome. What does this mean? Let's take a look at, again, the word serious we can dismiss, right? So we can say any outcome because the definition of serious in the previous paragraph is so broad that it could be really anything. It doesn't have to be a certain thing. So one example would be if a person has cancer, then a cancer therapy would be considered to be effective if it had an impact on one of the chemotherapy outcomes. So even though the drug may not improve the person's survival from the cancer, because, let's say, the drug might lower the inconvenience of chemotherapy, let's say, or be perceived to lower that inconvenience, then it would be approved. Now, the next thing is it can improve the diagnosis of a serious condition where early diagnosis results in an improved outcome. Okay, it's interesting. And decreasing a clinically significant toxicity of an available therapy that is common and causes and may cause discontinuation of treatment. So if patients are stopping a therapy because they don't like it, maybe it makes them puke or something, then a drug that reduces the puking from that side effect can get fast-track status and an ability to address emerging or anticipated public health need. What is that? That's something that does not exist. So a drug can get fast-track status if it treats a non-existing condition. So if it treats something that hasn't happened yet. For example, if the government is planning a false flag epidemic, then it can say, all right, fast-track these vaccines because we think we're going to have an epidemic in about 2 months, 2 weeks, and 10 minutes. So another reason for fast-track. Now notice that there's really not a whole lot of benefit for the patient so far in this fast track thing. Now, what does fast track mean to the company receiving this marvelous treatment, intervention? First of all, a drug that receives fast track designation is eligible for 1, more frequent meetings with FDA to discuss the drug's development plan and ensure collection of appropriate data needed to support drug approval. So they can meet frequently, more frequently with the FDA to basically shepherd their drug through to make sure that this approval process ends in a positive outcome. Next, they get more frequent written correspondence from the FDA about things like the design of the proposed clinical trials and the use of biomarkers. So the FDA actually tells them, if you do it this way, then we're more likely to approve it. Now remember, we've already given these people grant money. Okay. And also eligibility for accelerated approval and priority review if relevant criteria are met. We'll see more of that later. But then there's a rolling review. This means that a drug company can submit completed sections of its license application or new drug application for review rather than waiting until every section of the application is completed before the entire application can be reviewed. So if an application has 10 parts, they submit part one, it gets reviewed. They submit part two, it gets reviewed, and so on. So if you have each part individually reviewed, then at the end of the process, it's like, well, all these pieces have been in approval. Wait, what if what happened in section one nullifies what happened in section four? In other words, if the application has inconsistencies, no, not a problem. Because this rolling review makes it possible to get incremental approvals as you go. The limitation, fast track designation must be requested by the drug company. That's it. And it can be initiated anytime during a drug development process. So a drug company can submit a regular drug and say, oh man, this process is taking way too long. And then simply request fast track designation. And so once they get fast track designation, they get the benefits above, which is early and frequent communication and segmental approval. And this leads to earlier drug approval and earlier access by patients to a drug which might possibly maybe be effective. This is interesting. So the next designation that the FDA is authorized to extend is breakthrough therapy. Now, breakthrough therapy designation is a process designed to expedite the development and review of drugs that are intended to treat a serious condition. Now, remember, serious condition has been defined as any condition. And preliminary clinical evidence indicates the drug may demonstrate substantial improvement. So the preliminary evidence does not need to demonstrate that there is substantial improvement. Again, this is preliminary evidence. So even if it indicates substantial improvement, that indication may not be borne out by future studies. And so they're making it even less demanding than that. They're saying this preliminary evidence indicates the drug may demonstrate substantial improvement. So this preliminary evidence does not need to be compelling. And then it has to demonstrate substantial improvement on a clinically significant endpoint. This is very important. A clinically significant endpoint may not be of material benefit to the person's life expectancy or quality of life. So let's give an example of a clinically significant endpoint. If an individual is at risk of heart disease, let's say they might have heart disease, a clinically significant endpoint might be their cholesterol level. While this might be called a clinically significant endpoint, it turns out most people who have heart attacks have a normal cholesterol. So how clinically significant can the cholesterol be? And so what we have then is a smoke and mirrors game where clinically significant endpoints, we can call these like markers or like the orange cones on the highway, they can be moved and placed, arbitrarily designated. And the term clinically significant endpoint may not necessarily be something that impacts the patient's quality of life or length of life. And to determine whether the improvement over available therapy is substantial, again, is a matter of judgment. This means that the FDA individual, official, designee making this decision can never be found in error because it's a matter of judgment. That means blank check, say yes whenever you want to, and no whenever you want to. But, of course, the pressure is towards saying yes. I mean, after all, it is called the Breakthrough Therapy Program. Now, so the magnitude of the treatment effect, it can be depend on, and can include the duration of the effect and the importance of the observed clinical outcome. So in other words, the drug could maybe be effective for 2 days, 2 minutes, or 2 weeks. In general, the preliminary clinical evidence should show a clear advantage over available therapy. So again, should show, that means it may not show, probably doesn't show. And so here we have the FDA employee being put in a position of granting breakthrough therapy status to a drug, and the drug does not need to show a clear advantage. It should show, but does not need to show a clear advantage over available therapy. There's an observed clinical outcome, and this clinical outcome can basically be at the pleasure of the applicant. And then clinically significant endpoints, the same thing. So there really is no basis for denying breakthrough therapy status. Now, for the purpose of the breakthrough therapy designation, clinically significant endpoint, they're saying, refers to an effect on irreversible morbidity or mortality. So in other words, the person will experience less mutilation as a result of their disease or other therapies given for the disease, or on symptoms that represent serious consequences of the disease. So it can treat merely symptoms, but not the disease. So just to make things clear, this endpoint can be an effect on an established surrogate endpoint. So in other words, just as I mentioned before, a surrogate endpoint would be cholesterol level, not heart attack. And so an effect on an established surrogate endpoint, so representative of another endpoint. An effect on a surrogate endpoint or intermediate clinical endpoint, considered reasonably likely to predict a clinical benefit. For example, if you want to fly from New York to San Francisco, many planes that go from New York to San Francisco stop in Chicago. And so Chicago could be considered an intermediate clinical endpoint for the sake of this discussion. So this means that any airline that decided to sell a ticket to Chicago could represent that ticket as a ticket to San Francisco. Now, to the person buying a ticket, this is pretty deceptive because once you get to Chicago, you get on another plane, the plane can go anywhere. But this is what the FDA, by law and statute, is obligated to say yes to. So they're obligated to say yes to a drug that has an effect on a surrogate endpoint, which would be cholesterol level, that's bad enough, but now they can even pick an intermediate clinical endpoint. And this is where you get into blocking receptors and changing this level and changing that level when at the end of the day, the person has no benefit. Also, it can have an effect on pharmacodynamic biomarkers that do not meet criteria for an acceptable surrogate endpoint, but strongly suggest the potential for a clinical meaningful effect on the underlying disease. Now, if you're a woman and a guy proposed marriage to you in a way that strongly suggests the potential for a clinically meaningful liaison, you might not even recognize it as a marriage proposal. Similarly, if we judge a drug by having a strongly suggestive potential for a clinically meaningful effect, it might not be clear that that drug has any effect at all. And, of course, a significantly improved safety profile compared to available therapy. So it could be simply less noxious again, with evidence of similar efficacy. So if present therapy is ineffective, then this drug could also be equally ineffective, but not as irritating or noxious. So once the drug gets this this designation, it can become, it gets all the fast-track benefits, and it gets intensive guidance on an efficient drug development program, beginning as early as phase one. That's pretty early. And then an organizational commitment involving senior managers. That's pretty impressive. That's impressive. So we've done that. We've turned the FDA into a drug evaluation and approval organization into a handmaiden for the profitability or profits, I guess you could say in this case success, of a drug company. So as if that's not enough, there are more benefits. So we've got the fast track designation, the breakthrough designation, the orphan drug designation, and now we have accelerated approval. What is accelerated approval? Now by now you're getting the hang of this. So we've now got a drug that is possibly, probably, maybe effective. And that's, you know, this is the FDA's own words here. And so for accelerated approval, what they're saying is when studying a new drug, it can sometimes take many years to learn whether a drug actually provides real benefit on how a patient survives, feels, or functions. And a positive therapeutic effect that's clinically meaningful, such as clinical benefit. So what they're saying is, well, this is really an unfair burden on a drug company to insist that the drug company study the drug for as long as it takes to show a meaningful effect for the patient. So in 1992, the FDA instituted the Accelerated Approval Regulations. So these regulations allow drugs for serious conditions, and with serious condition, we know is any condition, that fill an unmet medical need, that means an area where the patient is not spending his full net worth on therapy, to be approved based on surrogate endpoints. So using a surrogate endpoint enabled the FDA to approve these drugs faster. So in other words, because the drugs did not show benefit to patients, the drug company, of course, with the assistance of the FDA, was able to pick something else that the drug did. So he said, well, geez, we can't show any evidence of benefit, so we'll show evidence that the blood pressure drops 2 points. Yeah, that's it. And so now that's just an example. But this means basically there's no obligation in the accelerated approval process to show indication that the drug has a positive benefit to the patient. And this is why we're seeing drugs that are less and less effective and more dangerous. Now, in 2012, Congress passed the Food and Drug Administration Safety Act Innovations. This is 2012, so that's recent. And what they said is they wanted to base accelerated approval that fill an unmet medical need on whether the drug has an effect on a surrogate or intermediate endpoint. So as recently as 2012, in the face of all the evidence that these drugs the FDA is approving are increasingly more dangerous and increasingly less effective, the Congress passes an act loosening approval criteria even more. So a surrogate endpoint such as a laboratory marker or measurement, an X-ray image. Now, as a person who went to medical school and practiced medicine, I can tell you that X-ray images often lag as much as 6 weeks behind the actual clinical picture. In other words, the X-ray can still be improving while the patient is declining and actually getting worse because the X-rays can be as much as 6 weeks behind. And this is an absolutely awful thing. So a physical sign or other measure that is thought to predict clinical benefit, not that it does, but that's thought to predict clinical benefit, but is not itself a measure of clinical benefit, can be used as a measure. And I'll give you an example. In the United States, there's a condition called suicide. And among doctors, there's incredible pressure to predict who's going to commit suicide and who isn't going to commit suicide. And so this conscientious university in Minnesota, they did a study. They got together case studies, about 100 people who were depressed. Some committed suicide, some didn't. And they said, okay, to the psychiatrist, you pick the criteria. What are the 42 things you want to use to decide who's going to commit suicide and who it wasn't? So psychiatrists agreed, okay, we're going to use these criteria, so many points, whatever. So they applied this criteria to these test subjects. And they said, okay, these are the 30 people we think are going to commit suicide. The doctor's prediction was so unreliable that it turned out that their prediction of suicide was actually a negative predictor, that the criteria they had picked to predict a clinical endpoint, in this case suicide, was totally unreliable. And that's often, in fact, it's usually the case, which of course is why so many people die at the hands of medicines, because these chosen predictor points are unreliable. So what then the government, the Congress has done and has directed the FDA to do is to use these surrogate predictive measures. And this, again, makes it more likely that the drug will be totally ineffective and even damaging. And so what they're saying here is using surrogate or intermediate clinical endpoints can save valuable time in the drug approval process. It makes it very, very quick. So instead of having to wait to learn if a drug actually extends survival for cancer patients, the FDA can approve a drug based on evidence that the drug shrinks tumors. So in other words, a drug cannot extend survival for cancer, but early on show that tumors shrink. And if you've ever been on, say, prednisone therapy, you know that when prednisone therapy is started, it's like, oh, my God, oh, I feel so much better. And you'll feel better for maybe a few days or so, and then, boom, it seems like it stops working. Or even worse, more devastating side effects appear. And so this gives FDA the luxury of approving a drug based on a criteria that has nothing to do, whatever, with survival or even a real clinical benefit. So the drug company, they're saying, will still need to conduct studies to confirm that this marker, for example, tumor shrinkage on an X-ray, actually predicts that patients will live longer. So these studies are known as phase 4 confirmatory trials. And so this is actually what in medical school was discussed. So when I was in medical school, they told me, oh, geez, you know, we've got phase 1, phase 2, phase 3, and phase 4. And man, if only we could let the government have us do our phase 2 work at the phase 4 level stage, and then we could start collecting money for these drugs before we really knew if they were safe or even effective, and that would be just so much better, and so many more drugs would be developed. Well, the problem with this thinking, of course, is that, of course, more drugs will be developed, but you've pretty much removed all safety. So where confirmatory trials verify clinical benefit, the FDA will generally end this requirement, and approval of the drug can be withdrawn or the labeled indication of the drug change if trials fail to verify clinical benefit. So in other words, you have a drug, you've approved it via fast track, you now discover the drug has no clinical benefit, and what they're saying is, well, we just changed the label use for the drug. And so at no point is a remedy to withdraw the drug from the market. It's like, oh, wait a minute, we granted you approval with the assumption this drug was beneficial. We've now found it's not beneficial, so we're just going to change the labeling. We're not going to take it off the market. We're not going to withdraw our approval because it was given too hastily. So they have another thing. Just in case accelerated review is not quick enough, accelerated approval, they now have something called priority review. And so each drug marketed in the United States has to go through a detailed FDA review process, of course. So a priority review designation means the FDA's goal is to take action on an application within 6 months. This is compared to 10 months. So a priority review designation will direct overall attention and resources to the evaluation of applications for drugs that, if approved, would be significant improvements in the safety or effectiveness of the treatment, diagnosis, or prevention of serious conditions when compared to standard applications. Now again, serious conditions, we realize, by the way it's designed or defined, is any condition. So if the drug proposed is in any way better than an existing or standard application, I mean, it could be a pill that's easier to swallow. It could be something that's twice a day instead of three times a day. Any of these things, then it's eligible for priority review and has to be reviewed in 6 months instead of 10 months. Now, this has a net effect, by the way, of any drug that doesn't have priority review designation basically gets ignored. So significant improvements may be demonstrated by the following examples. Increased effectiveness in treatment, prevention, or diagnosis of a condition. Elimination or substantial reduction of a treatment-limiting drug reaction. So again, substantial reduction. What is substantial reduction? Not clear. So this one would be a criteria that pretty much any drug could meet. And document enhancement of patient compliance. In other words, what I mentioned before, twice a day instead of three times a day, or once a day instead of three times a day. So enhancement of patient compliance that is expected to lead to an improvement in serious outcomes. Again, it has the expectation of, not proof of, not evidence of. And evidence of, now the next one is evidence of safety and effectiveness in a new subpopulation. So in other words, if you have an arthritis drug and you want to introduce a new arthritis drug, then you'd say, wait a minute, this new arthritis drug is helpful in 10% of those who are presently taking the old arthritis drug. It's a advancement. A good example of this is Vioxx. Vioxx is the arthritis drug that is believed to be responsible for the death, 132,000 heart attack deaths in arthritis patients. But what was the marketing of this drug? The marketing of this drug was that since it was a COX-2 inhibitor, not a general COX inhibitor that inhibited COX-1 and 2, that it would result in fewer ulcers and bleeding. And it turns out that, one, it had no superior pain relief over existing drugs in the market. But because it was marketed as possibly leading to or expecting to lead to an improvement in serious outcomes, it was permitted on the market, even though it did not reduce ulcer or bleeding. It increased massively the death by heart attack. And so here we see the consequences of using this one little clause used for this drug, Vioxx, and possibly its sister Celebrex, be responsible for the death of at least 135,000 Americans. That's a pretty, actually, conservative estimate. So the FDA decides on the review designation for every application. An applicant can expressly request priority review. So at every point in this, the applicant gets to direct the designation and the classification of their drug application. So fast track, breakthrough therapy, accelerated approval, priority review are intended to make, and they use this word, therapeutically important drugs available at an earlier time. Now, therapeutically important drug, if you ask any drug company, they measure drugs by how much money they earn. So in other words, a potential blockbuster, big earning drug needs to get out there earlier. And of course, they're saying this does not compromise the standards for the safety and effectiveness of drugs to become available through this process. I don't know if they're saying that the drugs through the regular process are already pretty dangerous, so this can't do any much more damage. And, you know, they're certainly in a position to know. I'm not, but it makes sense. So let's see what the business side of this. What does Thomson Reuters say about this? Now, who is Thomson Reuters? Thomson Reuters is a life sciences consulting group, and they perform economic analysis. And what they've done is they've looked at orphan versus non-orphan drugs. And this is really an eye-opener, and what you need to take a look at is this is being written about the industry by financial analyst. And financial analyst's job is to give some indication as to the financial state or financial consequences of what's going on. And this is often used by other organizations as a guide for investment in other activities. All right, so now you know. So here's one thing. What Thompson and Reuters is saying is that the orphan drug program has become economically very important. There's 7,000 rare diseases worldwide, and the number of such diseases is rising at the rate of 250 diseases per year. So every year, 250 new rare diseases are being discovered. And so these diseases only affect a small group defined by 200,000 people or less, but collectively, they affect tens of millions of people in North America. In other words, if inventing 250 diseases per year, which means bringing 200,000 people times 250 under the classification of having a rare disease, soon every person in the United States will have at least one disease whose drug is classified as an orphan drug. So hold that thought. And so what they're saying then is there's a shared global desire to address the unmet treatment needs of rare diseases. And so in the United States, Singapore, and Japan, in Europe, they have the Orphan Drug Act, and offering pharmaceutical companies profitable incentives to focus on rare diseases. And they herald this last decade as the most productive period in orphan drug development, in designations and approval, and an increased focus on precision medicine. Now, they're saying is careful analysis of the economics and investment case for orphan drug development and commercialization. This report shows that while orphan drugs target a much smaller population than traditional mainstream drugs, the high cost of therapy and attractive development drivers, the advantages the FDA gives, which I mentioned before, such as government incentives, smaller and shorter clinical trials, extended exclusivity, that means monopoly power, and high rates of regulatory success have made top orphan drugs equally viable as their non-orphan peers. And so what they're saying then is drugs for rare diseases can secure higher prices due to the limited size of the patient population, there are fewer, if any, competitors, and a high level of unmet need. And the industry's most expensive drug, Soliris, costs more than $409,000 per year per patient who took that drug. And so $409,000 per year per patient, and they made $541 million in total sales for pills that could, you know, not even 20 pounds worth of pills. I'm guessing, but that's... this is not a lot of pills. We're talking about pills for 1,000 people. So companies investing in rare diseases have been able to maximize the sales potential of existing drugs by repositioning them into additional rare disease categories. Now, this totally wipes out the intent of the orphan law, which was to make drugs available for people with these rare diseases, right? So what's happening then is a drug that's already on the market whose profits are sagging, gets reclassified as an orphan drug. And this means that the drug company can increase the price for that drug. It now has the benefit, by the way, of being an orphan drug, which is a 7-year marketing monopoly on this drug. And profits are absolutely exorbitant. And so what they're saying then is this has become a new profit center. And you can expect your low-cost drug that you've been taking for whatever period of time to reposition into an additional rare disease category, thus raising the price for actually all people who take the drug. Interesting. And so they go on to talk about peak value of drugs averaging $34.3 billion in overall revenue potential compared to only $8 billion for drugs with only one orphan disease indication. So now drugs are being qualified by the FDA as an orphan category for more than one disease. So now what they're saying is a marketing strategy is to get orphan status for more than one disease, and that's a sure way to profits. And so these valuations reflect the broad interest of the financial markets in the orphan disease business model. And this firm notes that the current sales and profit outlook related to orphan drug development is strong and positive. And the increased stratified approach in the market could result in more scrutinized drug pricing, which could impact the business model materially. However, the expectation is that the model will remain a competitive edge over traditional primary care. So this competitive advantage will be essential in the face of anticipated continued decline in the traditional primary care business model. Very, very interesting. So what's happened then is the FDA has become a handmaiden to profits for the drug companies. And what this means then is we're going to have more drugs being put into a scrutiny process that turns a blind eye to effectiveness. It turns a blind eye to negative outcomes because of the type of marketing required or testing required is really minimal. And so what they're saying here in this financial report is the revenue-generating power of an orphan drug, just as with non-orphan drugs, will lessen once it moves into generics market. Get this, though. An orphan drug gets 7 years of marketing exclusivity. This means that the drug company can choose to patent the drug at the end of this exclusivity process, giving the drug the 7 years of marketing exclusivity, followed by the regular 14 to 20-year patent life. How about that? So the 7-year orphan exclusivity is what they can allow to run first and then have the patent kick in. And this is just really just an incredible ka-ching. So what we have here is legalized homicide, legalized murder. Actually, it's time to answer questions. If people have questions, you can click on there. Well, I tell you how you can become a part of the solution here. As I said, we're not going to have you bother your politicians. It's really not necessary. But individually, then, you have to ask yourself, what am I going to do? What's my role in all this? Well, first of all, one thing to take a look at is if you're going to take a drug, first of all, if it's FDA approved, it's definitely not safe. That's what I would say. My personal opinion, not the opinion of the station. But if you're going to take a drug, ask your doctor, is this an orphan drug? He says, I don't know. Then ask him, could he find out? So if it's an orphan drug, then you know it has not gone through a regular safety process. So it's going to be less safe and less effective. So that's number one. Ask if the drug you're taking is an orphan drug. But even more importantly than that, I think it's time for each one of us to take a look at our role in the present system that murders people. If you're one of the 42 or 41 million Americans employed in the healthcare industry, you have to ask yourself, is this really what you want your life to mean? That you stood up and had the courage to murder fellow Americans. Now you might say, oh, Dr. Daniels, oh, that's a reach. You know, I'm a competent doctor. I'm a caring nurse. I'm just the orderly that mops the floors. All I do is turn them over. Without me, they'd get bed sores and die sooner. I think we have to stop rationalizing that. And I think that's already happening. I mean, the fact that 35% of adults in the United States are not even looking for work doesn't mean they're not employed, but not even looking for work suggests that many people may have already made this decision, maybe seeking self-employment or seeking meaningful work where their work every day doesn't result in harming other people, let alone murder. So I think we need to take a look at what we're doing with our life, with our day. You know, even if you're just an accountant for a healthcare corporation, maybe you can be an accountant for something else. Maybe there's something else you could do that'd be more meaningful. But I think the time has come, and the number of people dying is so great that Each one of us needs to ask ourselves that question. For example, would you work in a military factory making bombs if you knew those bombs were being dropped on the United States citizens right here in the United States? Would you work in a factory that was manufacturing nerve gas if you knew the nerve gas was being sprayed in the chemtrails above us? Well, hopefully not. And so I think that's the kind of critical thinking that needs to be applied to the occupation of American citizens. That just because you get paid a superior amount of money to do something doesn't mean that it's worth doing or that you should do it. So I have a question here. See if I can push this button. Yes, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes?
Hi. I'm in crowded company. Oh, okay. So I guess my comment is, have you heard about the little girl who went into the hospital, children's hospital, to have her tonsils removed and her adenoids, and she wound up bleeding out, and now she's brain dead, but the family does not want her to be removed off of life support. But mm-hmm. they're trying to get a court order to actually take her off life support.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's an example of murder by medicine. Because how do you go into a hospital and then you come out of it fine, but then all of a sudden you just burst out into bleeding everywhere. I remember you talking about a dentist who had gone to the hospital and they had done that to him where he bled everywhere and he was blind. So I'm wondering what your opinion is.
Oh, okay. Thank you. I'll answer that. No problem. First of all, what many people don't understand and many parents are not told is tonsil and adenoidectomy is actually a very difficult surgery because you have to put the breathing tube into the patient either through the nose or through the mouth. It doesn't matter. But the tube passes right by the area where the surgery is being done. And that makes it very difficult to do the surgery and maintain the airway. So it's easier for the tube to slip out. It's easier for all kinds of things to happen. And, you know, so tonsils and adenoids removed is not a trivial surgery. That's number one. Number two, what's really at play with what you're discussing is two things. One, the right of the medical industry to murder people. And two, the right of the industry to then decide once its profits are maximized that they're going to pull the plug, so to speak, so no further drain on profits will take place. And even the next thing, which is even more alarming, is once this kid gets disconnected, then you go to the parents and say, well, what about organ donation? And then that generates another $11.4 million of activity. So it's absolutely atrocious. And again, I think people need to ask themselves, where do they draw the line? You know, are you willing to work? Are you willing to be in the operating room when those things happen? Are you willing to mop the operating room floor afterwards? Are you willing to prepare the operating room? Are you willing to work for the company that makes the anesthetic gas? You know, at what point are you willing to say, I will not be a part of this? And at that point, when people start taking that personal look, that's when there'll really be a change. So next week's topic is, where do you draw the line? At what point have you had enough? Are you willing to take mutilation, murder, rape? Just what are you willing to accept? Because that's what the healthcare system is going to dish out. So I'm going to talk about where that line is and where the various lines are. And so you can decide for yourself where you want to draw the line. I want to mention Vitality Capsules will be going on sale, 50% off sale. You'll be getting emails about that. One last question here. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, doctor. I just wanted to share a situation where, I have a couple of questions, if you don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
One is about this discovery session, and other is more of a comment. My dad passed away last winter, and I really feel like medicine killed him, and I think that it seems like a lot of our elderly are victims of this in nursing homes.
Right.
of murder by medicine in the family. Our family was left feeling hopeless, because how can you go up against a doctor or the hospital who basically killed him?
You have to look at it as murder and leave off the medicine part.
Yeah.
So you would go to a district attorney.
Okay.
That's
it really hurts, because we feel helpless.
And abuse. I mean, somebody got paid for this very well.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure of it.
Now, well, there you go.
Yeah.
That's the problem right there. You're sure of it. So that means that you were not paying for this bill in nursing home. Either Medicare was paying, or Medicaid was paying, or some other entity was paying. And this is the
That's true.
Okay, this is the step for losing control. Because what happens then is the insurance company actually puts pressure on the nursing home to somehow terminate care at the point where the insurance company no longer wants to pay. And so terminate care. How do you terminate care?
Hmm.
Now, if they were to say to you, you've got to take your loved one home because the insurance company won't pay, well, then you'd give the insurance company a lot of heat. But instead, they just terminated care, you know, by terminating the life. And that's the problem, is when you allow someone else to pay for your health care, then that someone else has a bigger interest or control in deciding whether you live or die. It's often a pretty casual thing. Hospice is very dangerous as well. But that's the other thing, is if you're not willing to accept the responsibility of paying for your health care, then you have to realize that you're going to lose some very, very vital control. And in this country, murder is legal. As long as you get paid for it, it's okay. You just can't murder for free. You can't go kill your neighbor because the dog is barking or something. But it's okay to murder someone in a hospital bed for profit.
Yeah. Wow. Can I ask you one more thing?
Yeah.
Doctor, I was selected to have a discovery session with you after speaking. You asked me to, you know, fill that or apply for
mm-hmm.
that, but the date that Gabriel sent me the email, I was in traveling with my family and away from email. So the date was yesterday, and it passed. Am I able to still be able to have a discovery session with you?
Yes. Well, Gabriel will be back. Should be back day after tomorrow. It'll be the 2nd. And then I'll
mm-hmm.
have her contact you, and she can give you some more options.
Okay.
Yeah, because the holidays
are
ahead.
Do you need my name?
No, I think we have it.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, great.
Thank you
so much, and I really appreciate all that you're doing.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Okay, great. Okay, that is the end of tonight's show, and I hope each one of you will really look in your heart, look at what you're doing for a living, and ask yourself, could you be contributing to this murder by medicine? Because it's something that each citizen individually is going to have to do everything they can to stop this. This is not something our government is particularly really equipped to handle, to tell you the truth. Okay, well, Happy New Year, Happy Holidays, and we'll see you next week with How Much Can You Handle?